This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs in for Melinda Penkava. 10 professional baseball teams call North Carolina home. All are in the minor leagues, from the AAA Durham Bulls to the rookie league Burlington Indians. The teams are made up of players chasing the dream to one day reach the majors. Most won't make it. They'll spend a few years taking countless bus trips and playing thousands of games, but eventually they'll have to give up their dream. Today on The State of Things, we're talking about the life of a minor league baseball player. And we're joined in the studio by Chris Klein. He's a writer for the Durham-based magazine Baseball America and just completed a 7-day trip in which he suited up with teams in the Pittsburgh Pirates organization. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you, Rusty. I appreciate it.
So now you traveled with two teams, the Nashville Sounds, that's a AAA club, and the Lynchburg Hillcats, single-A. So what's the difference between single-A and AAA?
There's a lot of difference. Just an instruction basis. In Class A, they try to set the fundamentals straight and try to create a foundation for players. In AAA, they're pretty much on their own.
AAA is the closest, the level just below majors. In other words, if you're at AAA and you're going to move anywhere, you're going to go, or move up, you're going to move to the majors? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And there were plenty of players there that were moving up and down from Pittsburgh to Nashville when I was there, which was kind of interesting to watch as well.
Right. And did you have, how different is the quality of play at, say, AAA from the majors?
It's not that much different at all. You get a lot of guys who have, in AAA, you see a lot of players who have been around the block a little bit, have major league time. The games are faster than they are at the lower levels. And the quality of play is big league quality.
Mm-hmm. And if you can give a kind of a simple layman's description of just the way the system works, what is the connection between these major league clubs and these single A, double A, and triple A affiliates?
They have a relationship with the big league club to create prospects, create players, and funnel them through the system, starting off in the Gulf Coast League or the Arizona League, which is rookie ball, all the way up through low Class A. High A, double A, triple A.
Right. How do the stakes differ for these players at the various levels? What's at stake for a single A player and what's at stake for a triple A player?
I think it depends on the personal situation. If you have a draft pick who's a high pick, a first rounder, you're going to see a lot more expectations out of that guy because of the investment that's involved. If you got a guy who's a 38th rounder or maybe a guy who wasn't drafted at all, you might see them first of all, not get the chances that a first rounder would get, and not have the ability to stick around as long.
Right. Well, you talk about a first rounder, a high prospect, a top prospect in a system. How much pressure does a guy like that feel day to day? I mean, does he feel the pressure of the club's expectations?
A lot of pressure. Some guys are different than others. Some guys will hide it better than others. I just was talking to a first rounder in 99 who was back in A-ball at age 26, which oldest player on the Lynchburg club. He was released by the Astros, a guy named Mike Rosamond, and just very candid about how you never think you're going to get released. You know, as a first-round guy, you never even expect that. And then when it comes down, you start questioning everything. And he said, he called it the most depressing. It's the most depressing thing in your life, and the most depressing game in your life when things aren't going well. And he's been, kicked around, and so you see. Guys like that, the amount of pressure on different players across the board.
Hmm. So why do they do it? do all these players, why do they deal with this pressure day in and day out? Do they all think they're headed for the majors?
Well, I think they all believe that, and they all have, on varying levels, just a all-out love for the game. If you don't love the game and you're back in high A like Mike Rosamond, you're in the wrong place. They just have just this inner drive and desire to make it to the big leagues. It's tunnel vision to get there, and that's what you have to have in order to make that dream a reality.
Right. What's a typical day like for a minor league ball player? I mean, you've lived with these two teams,
right.
So what to take us through the course of a day?
When I was in Nashville, would start at. Get up at 10, have breakfast, get to the park, and I tried to get running in early. I was running 5 miles a day. around the park, around the track of the park. Took optional hitting. Some guys show up. Guys will mostly show up around one for optional hitting. Then they'll go through some different drills if guys need to go through infield drills. Take batting practice starts. You know, you have a stretch, and then batting practice starts at three or four. Then you know you're going through after BP. You do infield after infield. You go in and relax for about 45 minutes to an hour, and then it's time to hit the field for the game. And you don't end up leaving until, you know, depending on how long the game is, you don't want to throw in rain delays or anything like that. You leave around 11:30, 12 at night, and start, you know, all over again at 10 the next day. It's a grueling, grueling process.
Is it fun?
It was the most fun I had in my life.
But what about these guys that are doing it year in and year out? Is it a grind? Because, you know, again, look, a lot of us, I can speak for myself only, but I'm imagining there are others out there like me who sit at home thinking, I want to play baseball for a living. What's it like making it a living?
Well, after 10 days, I was saying to players about this, you know, I write about, and we at Baseball America write about guys who wear down during their first year. And I wore down after 10 days. Like, I was... Part of me was glad it was over. You know, I think guys that go through the spring training and then the full season, and then they have to go to instructional league in Florida or Arizona after the season ends, and then they have to go and play in the Dominican or Venezuela for the winter, and then, wow, it's April again. We need to, you know, start the season or go to spring training in February. I mean, that's, I can't imagine going through that for a full year, what those guys go through, because it's the same grind every day. That's not even throwing the travel into it.
And is your sense that many of them manage to keep it fun?
I think so. I mean, you get guys who are so focused on what they're doing, but so many of the guys, it's you've heard it compared to a fraternity so many times, but it really is that way. There are so many guys who like to keep things loose. You usually have three or four guys on a club who are just the jokesters, the pranksters. They're always looking for something, like, you know, a little angle to keep things loose. And you need that, I think, in that whole process.
Right. You know, I think of work anxiety, performance anxiety. I mean, we all deal with it. We all want to make sure that our bosses are happy with what we're doing and satisfied with our efforts. Is that any different? I mean, you talk about optional hitting. You talked about what a player can do. Aren't players always thinking, what can they do to show the manager that that they're as driven as anybody and that they're most motivated?
Well, I think so, and I think you see that. I mean, I definitely saw that a lot more in the lower level, in high class A. Just, you know, once you get to Triple A, a lot of those guys think that they belong back in the big leagues. They deserve another shot, and they can help a club at the big league level. And they kick around for, you know, 4 or 5 years, and I don't want to say they get lazy, but they believe that they deserve more than what they're worth, I think, at that point. A lot of those guys are just filling roster spots for clubs, I think I only saw three or four guys taking optional hitting every day in Triple A, which, it didn't really surprise me, but I mean, if those guys want to get back to that level, that's what they need to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The goal of minor league players essentially is to move up and beyond where they are until they get to the majors. So, what emphasis is there on winning for a minor league team?
That's a good question. Not much. You see all these fans, and they love to come out and see them play in the minor league level in these small towns. And, you know, they want to win. And a lot of organizations preach winning in groups, like keeping a group together and have them win level to level. But for the players, they want to win, but they want to move up too. So they're not even thinking about, let's say, you know, you leave Kinston, you know, North Carolina, and go to Akron, Ohio. They're just looking at that next level, and to see what their friends and what other guys in the organization are doing. I don't think the emphasis is as much on winning as it is with development.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been covering minor league baseball?
For 4 years now.
For 4 years. What did you learn about the life of a minor league player from spending this time with the teams in their dugouts that you maybe hadn't learned as covering it from the outside?
The grind, like I said before, it's brutal. It's a tough road to try and walk down. and I'm still nursing a little bit of an elbow injury at this point, but it's
just from throwing practice?
Just from throwing. But it's, you get the grind. The meals aren't very good. I went some days, a couple days, I didn't eat anything at all until the post-game spread was available after the game. So it's hard to stay focused. I don't think I realized how focused these guys have to be in order to do what they do.
Right. We just have a little bit before we take a break here, but I want to start talking about the players' lives and maybe get into that more in a bit. But just, are these guys making a living during the off season, or do they have to do some other really menial tasks or other boring jobs?
A lot of them, that's actually a story I'm working on. A lot of them do, work at grocery stores, or they'll work. I was talking to a reliever, Scott Sturkey, who's in the Braves system, and he's from Columbia, South Carolina. He told me he was delivering sandwiches on a bike in Columbia for, he said that lasted about 2 weeks. But I mean, they take odd jobs. They'll work, just wherever you could find work to try and make ends meet.
I imagine that'll keep a guy coming back to the Bush Leagues.
You gotta keep the dream alive. You get out there and actually see what life is like on the outside, so to speak.
We're talking with Chris Klein, writer for Baseball America, about the life of a minor league baseball player. This is The State of Things. And stick with us to hear more about the life of a minor league ball player. And in a little bit, too, we're going to hear from NPR host Neil Conan, who wrote Play by Play about his year as a play by play announcer. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs in for Melinda Penkava. We're talking about life in baseball's minor leagues. Christopher Klein of Baseball America magazine is with me in the studio. And joining us now from National Public Radio in Washington, D.C. is the host of Talk of the Nation and the author of Play by Play, Baseball, Radio, and Life in the Last Chance League, Neil Conan. Welcome to The State of Things, Neil.
Thanks, Rusty. My pleasure.
So, NPR listeners may only know you as a hard-hitting journalist, a veteran reporter and host, but a few years ago you took time off from the glamorous life with America's premier public radio network to do play-by-play for a minor league baseball team called the Aberdeen Arsenal. And the one question those same listeners and I want to ask you right now is why?
Because, I got the offer to do it. I looked at the schedule for the remainder of that summer, and at the time I was doing a lot of live events for NPR, and realized that this particular week I could either be doing the Republican convention in Philadelphia or a four-game set against the Bridgeport Bluefish. And, baseball just seemed like a lot more fun.
You're telling me it's an offer you couldn't refuse.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and by the way, I have to tell you, as a reporter in Connecticut with a Connecticut newspaper, I got to do opening day of the Bridgeport Bluefish, and a guy you know about, a very tall, lanky, funny pitcher with a big high kick, was the opening day pitcher. I'm guessing you know who I'm talking about.
With the Bridgeport Bluefish,
I heard you talk about him in an interview. I think the players called him the octopus.
Oh, the squid!
The squid, Al Sontag, right?
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. He came from all over the place. A guy whose motion you could never pick up. Danny Perez told me that. We were on coming back on the bus from Bridgeport. It's one of those great minor league moments of, you finish a game at, about 10:30, 11 o'clock, and then everybody showers, and I'm packing up the radio equipment and hauling everything down to the bus. And he tells me that, they call him the squid. The guy had almost pitched a no-hitter that night. Danny dribbled a 17-hopper through the middle infield in the ninth inning. And I was ready to kill him. Why didn't he tell me this before the game when I could use it? But then I realized, the season was young. We'd see the squid again.
And you got to talk about him.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, great. Well, you mentioned Danny Perez. I wanted to talk to you about you. You've traveled on the team, with the team, the Arsenal, on their bus, stayed with them in various motels. You've eaten with them, truly got to know them. And I wanted to ask you about a few personalities that stuck out for you and that you write about vividly in the book. And since you mentioned Danny Perez, can you tell us a little bit about him?
Well, Danny was a guy who, a star in high school, grew up in El Paso, and then a couple of different big-time college programs were after him. He ended up going to Oklahoma State, I think. Then sort of got a little carried away with himself, as, young athletes have a way of doing when they've been pampered their whole lives. and screwed up in college, and then had to go to a junior college for a year before he got back into it, and then was a high draft pick and made a little bit of money from the draft, and got to the point where he was an absolute stud at AA in his hometown of El Paso, and by his own admission, really screwed things up by getting a little too carried away.
Neil, we may have lost you there momentarily, but hopefully we're going to get you back. Chris Klein, Neil Conan was just talking about Danny Perez, a player he's come across, guy who showed full potential, showed great promise at one time, and may have squandered his opportunities by his own, bad judgment. Is this a typical story? Is this a story you've come across in your writing as a minor league reporter?
You see it sometimes. Most recently this year with Jeff Allison, who was probably the best high school pitcher coming out a couple years ago, and recently he didn't show up for spring training. He showed up late, just kind of showed up 3 weeks in, and there were questions. He failed a drug test, and the most recent story I've heard is that he overdosed on heroin. So you see guys who, like Neil was saying, pampered their whole lives, and Allison's a young kid. I mean, a lot younger at this point than Perez was when he admittedly screwed up. But the money's so much more now, the bonuses are so much more, and there's a lot more temptation.
Mm-hmm. Neil, I believe you're back with us, right?
I apologize for the problems. Yeah.
No problem. We were just getting filled in on another kind of a typical player story.
That's a terrible story. I was also your guest will know the story also of Matt Riley, a star young pitcher with the Baltimore organization, who again got called up to the majors a little early. Then the next spring, got involved in a fight outside of a strip club in Florida, and really had a big struggle for a couple of years before finally making it back to the major leagues. This year, he's been up and down.
Neil, let me turn it to another player if I can, because I don't think this player has encountered the same kind of problems we're talking about. You wrote about Tyrone Horn.
Ty Horn, yeah.
And he sounded like a pretty talented player in a lot of ways. What's kept him from becoming a well-known player?
Ty Horn was a terrific power hitter, and in fact, one of his bats, he used to call them his ladies, one of Tyrone Horn's ladies is in the Cooperstown Hall of Fame, because in a minor league game, in a double-A game, he became the first and, as far as I know, the only player ever to homer for the cycle. In other words, he hit a solo home run with one man on, with two men on, and a grand slam all in one game. Was a great power hitter who was always picked up by teams to, protect, in other words, bat behind their star draft picks. Pat Burrell, he batted behind Pat Burrell. He batted behind J.D. Drew. The reason Tyrone Horn never made it to the major leagues was that Tyrone Horn struck out a lot, and Tyrone Horn did not have any defensive position he could play. This was a little hard to persuade Tyrone.
Well, Neil, we're going to go from critiquing players to critiquing announcers, something you're talented at. I want to take advantage of this. This is all for me, folks. No. As our listeners have already heard, Neil, at the top of the show in our billboard, I got a chance to do some play-by-play myself last night for the Durham Bulls. For me, it was also a dream come true, as I'd given up on playing for the Yankees a long time ago. So what I'd like to do right now is play some of that for you and hear what you think of my performance.
Glad to.
Jorge Cantu looks at a first strike. He got to first on a walk last time up. And he takes a ball inside, 1-1 to Cantu. And Bulls looking to even it up. Braves ahead 1-0 here on three hits. Richmond also has one error. Bulls, zeros across the board. Cantor's hitting 306 on the season. 78 runs batted in. And he swings at an off-speed pitch. Misses. That's 1-2 against Cantu. Who looks at a pitch at a ball. That's 2-2. Connell delivers the 2-2 pitch, and Cantu misses. Strike three, and the Braves go down 1-2-3. And it's still Richmond Braves 1, Bulls nothing.
Okay, first of all, I was looking at my engineers, and they were looking at their watches, saying, how much longer do we have to listen to that? So, Neil, I was dying and waiting for the color commentator to come in there and fill some of that silence.
Yeah, you're really anxious for a couple of colorful anecdotes in there, aren't you?
Very, very, very anxious. So give me your uptake on that.
Well, it's, you know, you kept it straight. It was a little choppy in parts. Those yawning gaps, those are really hard to fill. It's astonishing.
Literally yawning, again.
It's astonishing when you do it how much time there is to fill in a baseball game. And one of the things that people who are much better at it than I am used to tell me when I was getting into it, you really want to get into a rhythm, and then they would say, you know, the problem with baseball, the guy throws over to first base six times in a row, where's your rhythm then?
Well, how did you make the adjustment, or how long did it take you, do you feel, to make the adjustment to get to where there was a real ease about doing this?
Well, I was, at the beginning, much worse than you were in that excerpt that we just heard there. I was really terrible when I started because I thought I knew how to do this, and it turned out that I was totally wrong. It took me, I would say, the better part of, well, I felt like it was 3 weeks to a month before I was competent, and maybe a couple of months before I was decent.
Right. Well, here's the frightening thing. I still think I have a shot. I still think I did okay. And I also want to thank the Bulls and WDNC 620 AM for letting me do that. Neil, you've covered wars. You've mm-hmm. been held hostage, as many NPR listeners know, when you were covering the first Gulf War. You have described this, or starting out as a play-by-play announcer, as one of the most frightening things you've ever done. Is that right?
Absolutely, because you know, A, I'd taken this, you know, sort of professional plunge to go do this. And, you know, as my wife used to tell me, she was so pleased that I'd managed to locate a sector of the broadcast industry that paid less than public radio. And then I had to prove myself. There was nobody to fall back on. There was no color guy in my booth. There was no engineer. There's no other producer. There's just me doing this. And the station and the team had both invested a fair amount of money in this project, and there I was messing it up. So, yeah, I was pretty scared.
We've been talking a lot about players. It is very hard to do play-by-play. You've attested to that. I've just demonstrated that. And the life of the player might even be harder. And did you find that too?
I think it is, because once you do figure out how to do play-by-play, it gets a little easier. I mean, there's a stiff learning curve, but once you're there, you're there. Baseball, boy, it's a hard game. There's so many things that can go wrong. You play every single day of the year. Almost every player has something physically wrong almost all of the time, nagging injuries of one sort or another. In the league I was in, half the guys were there because they'd suffered some sort of serious injury in minor league baseball and were trying to prove that they were coming back, pitchers with big scars on their elbows and players with zippers along their knees. It's a very difficult game. All kinds of, and even if you're good, as so many people have pointed out, you're going to fail 7 times in 10 as a batter, even if you're very good. So it's a tough game, and it's you're getting paid very little money. The conditions are difficult. The motels are difficult. The buses are difficult. And there is a nagging feeling at the back of most people's minds of, you know, when am I going to grow up and get on with my life? Because I can't do this forever. On the other hand, there's an opportunity to make your living with a glove and spikes. Who's going to turn that down?
I have a couple more questions for you, Neil. First, what kind of a person spends their entire professional life in the minor leagues? I mean, what, you know, these guys with zipper wounds and zipper scars mm-hmm. on their knees, what keeps them going every day?
Part of it is that this is all they've done since they were, you know, 8, 10, 12 years old. Every summer, that's what they do. They go play organized baseball. They get on the bus, and that sort of organizes their life. Part of it is the belief that so many athletes have, and these are very good baseball players. Don't get me wrong. These are, you know, how many guys are in the major leagues? What, 750? So you throw in, a few thousand more in the top rungs of the minor leagues. These are among the 5,000 best baseball players in the world. This is awfully good. And they think, you know, if I could just develop that off-speed breaking pitch, if I could just learn to hit the slider, I could be right there. I could be in the major leagues.
And the we should point out the Aberdeen Arsenal is in an independent league, so they're even
Aberdeen
step...
Arsenal's out of business.
Oh, well, there you go. So nobody playing for them is going to make it to the majors anytime soon. What about the fans, Neil? You grew up in New York like me, and I think rooted for the Yankees?
Absolutely.
Okay, two Yankees fans talking to one another. What's different about the attachment that fans feel for a minor league team as opposed to a major league team?
I think it's the local angle, and for certainly the affiliated teams have gotten a lot smarter about developing franchises in their own backyards, so that the Cleveland Indians AA franchise now is in Akron, Ohio. So you go see the Indians of the future. The Baltimore Orioles have almost all of their minor league franchises, except for their AAA franchise, in the state of Maryland now. So it's there's that local attachment not only to the team that's in your community, but then to the big league team, the parent club that's not all that far up the road. And if teams work it right, you can develop quite a relationship there. But it's, you know, you can sit so close to the game, you can talk to the players on the field, you feel as if you're right there. It's not an expensive way to spend an evening at most of these parks. If they're not in big cities, the parking is free. Admission is relatively nominal. These clubs mostly make their money off, like most major league teams, off beer and hot dogs, or in a lot of places these days, sushi. You know, who knows?
Now, I imagine, though, the fans at the major league level, certainly, they can identify with certain players. I mean, yes, players are moving a lot more these days in trades and stuff, but you still got a core group of players. Like, you know, a lot of Yankees fans probably think, when they think Yankees, they think Derek Jeter. They mm-hmm. think Bernie Williams. You don't get attached to players at the minor league level at the same way, right, because they're going so often.
Yeah, but they're so much closer to you while they're there. So that you do get to see them up close, and they're living in the community, and they're not living, remote from you. Like, as much as I admire Derek Jeter, I don't expect to run into him at the grocery store. In a minor league town, you're going to run into these guys who live there. They're part of the community while they're living there. Often, they're living with host families in the town, so it's a much tighter relationship while they're there.
And Neil, you did play-by-play for one season. You returned to National Public Radio. I'm sure a lot of listeners really appreciate that. But should I say you reluctantly returned?
I'll look at it this way. If the Montreal Expos move to Washington, I'll be applying for the job.
Great. Neil Conan, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure, Rusty.
Neil Conan, NPR host of Talk of the Nation and author of Play-by-Play. Thanks again. So, Chris Klein... again, you know, turning to the life of the minor league baseball player, some players have families that live hundreds of miles away during the summer months. Were family pressures evident for these guys?
Absolutely. After each game, especially when I was on the road with Lynchburg, it would go out to the waiting for the bus, and it would be like there need to be a different, like a separate satellite just for the guys using their cell phones. A lot of players told me you can't, you don't get to talk to your girlfriend much, your wife, because in the morning when you're up, when you get up around 10 or 11, she's at work. And, late at night when you get done with a game, she's sleeping. She's, so they often said, try dealing with those conversations. So it's definitely a pressure. And a lot of players on the lower levels for the most part, don't have children. There are a lot that do. On the club that I was with, nobody did. In AAA, there are kids running around the clubhouse, which is a very interesting
Is it an age thing? Typically, are they a little more mature, a little older at the AAA level?
Yeah, I wasn't, at 33, I wasn't old for AAA, but I was way old for Class A. Some players have their kids serving as bat boys. One night there was a fantasy football draft with all the players, and all of a sudden I see an outfielder come walking in pushing a baby carriage, and there's like a 2-year-old, and he pushes it over to one of the relievers' lockers and is just like, your wife just gave me Johnny here. You're gonna have to watch him tonight. So. She wanted to go see a movie or something that night. So it's a very interesting dynamic with the kids that are involved as well.
Right. And you wrote something about a cell phone frenzy one day that you came out of a game, I think, and you were going to make a cell phone call. And what did you see?
There had to be, 20 players out there all dialed up, just calling family, calling friends, girlfriends, just trying to stay in touch whenever they can. And it's tough to keep up with your family and keep up what's going on at home.
You talked about the fantasy football league, and I'm curious what do players typically do in their time off, or when they're not, you know, if they're on the bus or something. I mean, describe what's going on a bus ride.
On a bus ride, guys have their laptops. Guys will be watching movies on their laptops, or if the buses don't have video like a VCR on there, on the ride down from Lynchburg to Kinston, they were watching Bad Boys and Old School, just watching movies to kind of kill time. They go over scouting reports, but not so much. I mean, the bus is just a place to relax, even though, you know, your legs will fall asleep within the first 10 minutes.
Right. I'm curious, how do attitudes in the clubhouse at, say, AAA differ from attitudes in the single A clubhouse?
Wow. There, you'll see a lot more breaking of bats, a lot more water coolers being thrown in AAA than you will in, you know, the attitude is, like I said before, just the whole, I belong in the big leagues, get me back there now, so you don't see that as much in high A.
Great. This is The State of Things. We're talking about minor league baseball today. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. North Carolina's minor league baseball teams include the Warthogs, the Crawdads, and the Intimidators. All the minor league teams in North Carolina, 10 in all, are made of players trying to reach the major leagues. We're talking today about their life in the minor leagues with Chris Klein. He's a writer with Baseball America magazine. And joining us now is Tori Lavolo. He's the manager of the Kinston Indians. He spent 13 seasons playing professional baseball with the Detroit Tigers, New York Yankees, California Angels, Seattle Mariners, Montreal Expos, Oakland A's, Philadelphia Phillies, and Cleveland Indians. I hope I'm not missing any teams there. Tori, he retired in 2000 with a 224 average in 303 games at the major league level. Thanks for joining us, Tori.
That's no problem. I'm glad to be here.
Now, your job at Single A is to get guys ready for the majors. What's the challenge of managing young, ambitious players?
Well, I'll tell you, what people don't realize when they come to a ballpark is that it's really not about winning or losing ballgames. It's about developing players and getting them ready for the next level. And we call that player development. And each and every day, I think, what the fans do not realize is we are out there probably from 3 to 5 o'clock working as hard as ever on the shortcomings of the players' games, and watching them play in the game is more or less just the bonus, and just so you can evaluate where they're at. So, you know, we get after it pretty hard. There are some challenges which are very unique, but the bottom line is we got to develop major league players and send guys to the next level. In this case, which would be Double A.
At the major league level, you keep fans coming by having a winning team. How do you keep fans coming when you have a team that is not concerned, is concerned about winning?
Yeah, that's a good question, too. I mean, there's a very fine line there. What I try and do is I try and breed a winning environment and develop players in that winning environment. I think that's a very healthy place to develop that winning attitude. And, you know, unfortunately, sometimes it's really up to the scouting department to bring the players in. Once the scouting department brings the quality of player that we're looking for, it's a no-brainer that we're going to win our share of ballgames. And over the past 4 or 5 years, the Indians have lost a number of free agents and gotten some young players and some trades. And we have a tremendous core group of players that will be coming up through our system and helping the Cleveland Indians win. As a result, we have good players. And the good players developing in that system are going to help win ballgames. So it goes hand in hand.
So as a manager of a single-A club, if you're not measuring your success by, say, the win-loss columns, how are you measuring your success?
Well, you know what? I just get evaluated by my bosses, my farm director, the general manager, the assistant general manager. And I just put myself in good hands with the people I'm working with. I believe in all that they're trying to teach and all that they're trying to accomplish. And I just feel like if I'm a good baseball person, things will take care of themselves. I don't evaluate what I do on wins and losses, although you do get sidetracked by it. And here we are winding down the final month of the season, and we're all trying to gear up for the championship run. I'm not going to lie to you. I love to win. I used to tell everybody I cheat in cards against my mom. But you have to set that aside, develop your players, and just know that you're putting in quality work and giving the kids quality time, and things take care of themselves.
I hope mom's not listening.
No, she knows. Listen, she saw me cheating a few times, so it wasn't a big deal.
Now, you also played in Japan during your career. Was that a positive experience?
I think it showed me a different side of baseball. It was now a little more cultural diverse. I think I've gotten out there and I'm able to see what a player coming up from Latin America might go through when they come here and don't speak a language, and you know, just being all alone. I was in Japan with an interpreter, and I kind of shed him because I wanted to get that full experience of living in Japan, and it was a great time. I would have gone back. Unfortunately, I didn't do well. I got injured, and that was basically the end of my career.
How do you say low and outside in Japanese?
Yeah, no, I don't know that. I can only say a couple things when I was hungry. I knew I had to go. No, I had to go to McDonald's and order a Big Mac, but that was about it.
So what are you drawn most from your own career as a player and instructing some of these young guys?
You know, the experience that I had in knowing what a position player more specifically is going through each and every day, and I've tried to kind of highlight some pitchers as well to understand what they're going through, and that's been part of my development as a manager, to know what a pitcher goes through. As you know, I went through it as a position player, but I've just learned that communication is vital. Don't hold anything over a player's head. Just let them know what you're thinking at all times, and I open up every line of communication. If there's ever a problem, they can come in and see me, and we can talk about it. I want to put them in an atmosphere where they don't look at me like I'm the manager of the Kinston Indians. I'm more of a friend of theirs that manages the Kinston Indians. And as a result, I think I put them in a productive environment where they relax and take me out of the equation. Because I know when I was a young player, and it's changed over the years. Definitely changed over the years. When I was a young player, you know, playing for Lou Piniella, it was tough. You know, he kept you guessing at all times, and I didn't like that as a player.
And, Torrey, you are now a manager. You had to give up. You had to retire as a player. How hard was that?
It was time for me. You know, I remember the day it happened. I was working out with some younger players. I think I was 34, 35 years old, and I just flipped them the ball, and I said, I'll see you guys tomorrow, knowing that I just expired. It was one of those moments where it was time. Father time had me wrapped up pretty good, and it was hard for me to get around. I had the injury. And everybody said that you'll know when it's time, and I didn't. I was on the throttle full speed ahead until that day happened. I was in pursuit of my dream each and every day to play in the major leagues, and when it happened, it just hit me right over the head.
Torrey Lavolo, thanks so much for joining us today.
No problem. I enjoyed it.
All right. Torrey Lavolo is the manager of the Single-A Kinston Indians. He joined us by phone from Myrtle Beach, where the Indians take on the Myrtle Beach Pelicans tonight. And we're joined now by Brooks Badeau. He's an infielder with the... No, we are not joined by Brooks Badeau. Hopefully, we'll be getting him soon. Chris Klein, you've met Torrey Lavolo, right?
Yeah, I was working for the Kinston Free Press in Kinston, and I covered him, covered that club for the last 3 years before joining Baseball America.
How about him? Did you say you've seen him as a player? Did you ever see him in the minor league level as a player?
Not in the minor league level. I saw him. Well. That is true in AAA.
You've seen him as a manager.
Oh, absolutely.
In action. How does he rank as a minor league manager? I mean, what do you think? What do you think makes a good minor league manager? And B, you know, does Torrey Lavolo fit that profile?
Well, he does just a lot of things that he just said as far as being open with his players. But you know, he's a UCLA guy. He's got a degree in psychology. He's, you know, when I first walked into his office, I could feel him just kind of feeling me out and like. Kind of getting into my head a little bit as to what I was thinking. He has the ability to break down personalities and break down people very well, and he's a very good communicator. I think those are two things that make a good manager. He was just voted in our last issue as the best managerial prospect in the Carolina League, which is where he is. He's a tremendous person. He's got a great future ahead of him as far as managing goes.
Yeah, you know, actually, I'm kind of sorry I didn't ask him this, but I mean, how much are these minor league managers worrying about their own career, wanting to get up to the majors as coaches and managers?
Well, I think, you know, especially in Cleveland's situation, they're kind of set in their ways because the big league club's doing okay. And, you know, AAA, they're set there. And AA, they're set there. I think... You know, he could go and be a roving instructor, which they have guys that go around to all the different affiliates and work on defense, work on hitting, work on outfield, work on running. He could definitely do something like that as well. I mean, you have different angles, but he definitely wants to manage in the big leagues.
But typically, I mean, are managers themselves wanting to get ahead just like the players?
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely.
We are joined now by Brooks Badeau, an infielder with the Durham Bulls. He's played minor league baseball since being signed out of Florida State University in 1998, including the last three seasons with the Bulls. Brooks, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. You came into professional baseball 6 years ago. Is it meeting up with your expectations, or how different is it than what you thought it would be?
You know, a little of both. It's definitely meeting my expectations as far as the fun that I have with, you know, having the opportunity to go out there every day, and I still get the opportunity to put a uniform on. But, you know, obviously right when you sign, you think you're going to be in the big leagues as soon as possible, and obviously I'm still in the minor leagues hoping to get a crack at the big leagues someday.
Yeah. So you haven't had your shot up at the show yet?
No, I haven't been up yet.
How soon did it become clear to you that you had a possible future in professional baseball?
I think once I started, I guess once you hit your senior year of high school, scouts start coming to your game and talking to you and approaching you about different scenarios and things of that nature. And then once you either choose a path to go to college or professional baseball, you know, it becomes pretty realistic.
Right. Where else have you played?
I played to New York, you know, Florida, Orlando, St. Petersburg, and here. That's about it.
Mm. What's one of the craziest named teams you've ever played for?
I'm trying to think. I guess the Hudson Valley Renegades.
Renegades.
I miss the Montgomery Biscuits, which is now our Double A affiliate.
And has your dream changed at all? You're still hoping to play one day in the major leagues?
Yeah, definitely. That's what gives me my motivation and you know, keeps me excited about going to the park every day is the fact that one day I may have the opportunity to play in the big league.
How much consideration have you given to when that day might come? When you might have to give up on that dream?
I try not to think about it that much. You know, being in baseball, you have to approach each day. You know, you have to look. You can't look too far into the future because there's a lot of things that you can't control. People making decisions every day that you have no say so in. All you can do is go out there, put a uniform on, and do the best you can do. But naturally, you know, you have to have something to fall back on. So, I mean, I have thought about it a little, but that's just in case of an emergency, basically.
Well, Brooks Bedeau, best of luck to you.
Well, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Brooks Bedeau, an infielder with the Durham Bulls. Chris Klein, another example of a guy in an organization playing his heart out, you know, and happy to put on a uniform every day. You know, how typical is Brooks of the mentality of someone who's determined no matter how steep the odds?
I think it's very typical across the board, just with guys, especially in AAA. You know, they're a step away. That's what keeps them going. They're a step away. You never know when somebody's going to go down at the major league level. Or when they're just, you know, they'll get hot. They just, it's a constant mentality of just, you know, uber believing in yourself all the time, all the way out.
Jorge Cantu is a second baseman, I think, with the Durham Bulls. And he just spent some time with the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, which is the major league affiliate of them. Now he's back. How hard is that to come back? You know, how hard is it to just be up there for a little taste and then to come back?
Well, in Cantu's situation, I don't think it's that tough because he was having such a great year, a career year in AAA. I know that, you know, just to get that little taste of it sometimes is enough to fuel your fire that much more when you come back down. There was a player, Tony Alvarez, when I was in Nashville that had just been sent down to the Sounds when I was there from Pittsburgh. And he was just, you know, elated to be back. I think to more to share stories with people about his experience in the big leagues, and to get back there. You know, he was a little ticked off when I came out wearing his pants one day, but mistakenly.
Because you shared a locker, right?
Yeah, he's my roomie. But, you know, he was very elated about just about being back. And, I mean, I didn't think that – I thought he was going to be, you know, just ticked off about being back. And he was the exact opposite.
How revered is a guy like that in the clubhouse? When a guy comes back and he's been up in the big leagues, is Tony Alvarez does everybody flock to him to find out what it was like?
Well, I think so. They had two guys that were rehabbing too: Darryl Ward, a first baseman, and Humberto Cotto, was a catcher. When Ward came in to the clubhouse my first day, like, I have a goatee and you're not allowed to have facial hair, but the Pirates told me I didn't have to shave or anything. Everybody thought I was a big league guy because I had this goatee. After they found out that I wasn't anybody, you know, they do flock to guys like Ward. They do flock to to guys just to, A, watch them in BP, watch how they go about their business, watch how they carry themselves, because it is that big league mentality. You can see the separator of guys that have been there to guys that haven't been.
Right. And you have another interesting story about a guy who was sent down from AAA to AA on his birthday.
Right. Yeah, that was tough. He was pitched in the big leagues the last 2 years, I think, and he's just turned 31, and he got the news that, you know, they spun it where they needed help in AA in Altoona, which is where they're – Altoona, Pennsylvania, where their affiliate is. And, you know, they're pushing for a playoff run, so they spun it in a positive way. But there was nothing really positive about it. The night before, I saw him running around the bases with his two daughters. And, you know, the next day he's making, you know, packing up his bags and making arrangements for his wife and his two daughters who lived in Nashville to get back home to Portland. So it, you know, it's kind of that he was a very well-respected and well-revered player in the clubhouse because he had big league time and he was going to AA and people were very upset about that. So
we have just about a minute left, but, you know, baseball is a game. What about clubhouse antics? Were you ever worried about practical jokes?
I was petrified of practical jokes. I thought for sure, like, you know, the first day, Nashville's manager, Trent Jewett, was just all over me. He's just like, just so you know, I let the guys know and, you know, just expect something to happen. So I was expecting a hot foot or I was getting all sorts of, you know, just a little feedback about what guys have done in the past. And I was a little worried about that, but nothing happened in AAA. It happened in A-ball when I got fined. I was fined $20 for taking a unauthorized trip back to the hotel because someone had slashed the tires on our bus.
Any memorable comments from the dugout? I know guys razz each other, razz other teams. Anything strike you as memorable?
The only thing really is this guy Luther Hackman in Nashville, a reliever, was getting on this guy John Roush, who's he's 6'11", just like saying stuff, you know, like you should be in the NBA, you shouldn't be out there on the mound. You look geeky. You're, you know, this tall, skinny white guy, and it was just. He was on him, like, from the first inning to the sixth. It was just funny.
That's the state of things today. Thanks to Chris Klein for being here in the studio. He's a writer for Baseball America magazine, which is published in Durham. Thanks again, Chris.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank the Durham Bulls and WDNC 620 AM for allowing me to broadcast an inning during Tuesday night's game at the DBAP. In particular, thanks to broadcasters Steve Barnes and Neil Solens, who let me sit in their chair and whose profession I set back many years with my performance. Okay, folks. You won't be hearing me do play-by-play anytime soon. But thanks for listening to The State of Things. If you have a comment about our show, drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Rusty Jacobs.